You're listening to the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Welcome to the CEO Series. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University. Each week, the CEO Series takes you inside the minds and lives of some of Canada and indeed the world's top leaders to discuss strategy, leadership, and today's pressing business issues. And some of the world's top leaders have spent time with us. Justin Trudeau, Mohamed Yunus, Nobel Peace Prize winner, and Joanne Liu, International President of Doctors Without Borders. This show gives you a thin, well, perhaps not so thin, slice of the kind of thoughtful leaders leading some of today's most successful organization. Today, I'm delighted to be in Calgary, sitting down with an old friend, Adam Waterous, CEO of Waterous Energy Fund. Adam, good to see you again.
Nice to see you, Carl.
Tell us about your early years. Where did you grow up and what did your family do?
Sure. So I grew up in Ontario, went to high school in Toronto, and then went to Western for my undergrad. Got my HBA there, had a great time, and then worked at McKinsey for a couple of years. And then, Carl, as you know, I went to Harvard Business School. Way back in 1988. So, is when we
was it open
graduated.
Then? It was open then. So what, interesting, McKinsey, one of the great consultants in the world, doing a bit of research with them now. What did you learn at McKinsey, Adam, looking back on it?
First of all, I'm a big fan of, strategic consulting. I would encourage all young people who have an interest in business to consider starting their career at a strategic management consulting a firm. You get a very broad CEO level perspective on corporate challenges, corporate issues, and that's what I found. I loved my time at McKinsey, and like many people, I really wanted to be an entrepreneur, but I thought, and surprisingly, folks like things that that McKinsey kind of got a mental picture that most people are sort of big company types, but actually it spawns lots of entrepreneurs too, and I think it was really helpful for me starting my own businesses. So that was my experience.
So what was your first job out of the Harvard MBA?
So the first thing I did is I worked for a large real estate development firm called BCE Development. And they were building BCE Place in downtown Calgary, which is now Brookfield Place. I worked there for a little over a year. And then I went out on my own to become a real estate developer. I tried to try and learn the skills of real estate as quickly as I could. I did that for about a couple of years, and I've maintained an active hand in real estate, but then in 1991, so 30 years ago now, it's hard to believe, with my brother, we started a business called Waterous & Co., which was a M&A advisory firm dedicated exclusively to the oil and gas business, which over essentially the next roughly 15 years, we expanded, went into the United States, opened offices in Houston, Denver, but also went to London, Buenos Aires, Singapore, had a very big global footprint. And we then sold that business to Scotiabank in 2005. And when we sold it, it was the largest oil and gas M&A firm in the world. I actually stayed at Scotiabank ran their global investment bank for about 10 years until leaving to start this firm.
Today, I'm in Calgary speaking with Adam Waterous, CEO and founder of the Waterous Energy Fund, a highly successful oil and gas investment firm based in Calgary, Alberta. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. So, Sirisis, you've been an entrepreneur, but you've also been head of iBanking for one of the biggest banks in Canada. You're both a corporate guy and an entrepreneur. What's the difference between a corporate person and an entrepreneur in your mind, your experience?
So, I tell you, Carl, when I sold Watson & Co. to Scotiabank, one of the things I did is I agreed to stay on for another 3 years to help integrate the business into Scotiabank. And if you had asked me the day that I sold the business, what was the probability of me staying at Scotiabank longer than 3 years, I would have said zero. And the reason being is nothing to do with Scotiabank. It was that, you know, I hadn't had a boss since I was in my 20s. You know, it's very, most entrepreneurs, frankly, tend to be very hard to manage. They're very independent, opinionated. You know, it can be really quite difficult to fit into a corporate mold. I was actually, though, quite surprised by what a great work environment Scotiabank was, considering my trepidation, because there's lots of great things about running your own business, but there's also some great things about being part of a large platform. Running an investment bank in Canada, one of the neat things is, when you pick up the newspaper in the morning, you look at the business section, you know, you may not be working on every deal, but you'll have a pretty much a perspective on every single deal in any sector. Whether it's real estate, financial services, healthcare, tech, or where I started out, oil and gas. So it's an enormously stimulating a place to work. But I did ultimately leave just under 5 years ago, in January of 2017, to start this firm.
So what is your what does Waters Energy do? It's obviously an energy.
Yep.
So, you run it, but what does it do?
Yeah, so we're an oil and gas private equity fund. And what we do is invest in the upstream, meaning exploration and production component of the North American oil and gas sector. And essentially, you know, what made me leave Scotiabank, because I was really happy there, but I saw what I thought was a investing opportunity that certainly in my life I had not seen before. And I thought, geez, you know, if I don't take advantage of a certain market dynamic that was going on, I might regret it forever. And I wanted to have no regrets. And I thought I was in just a fortunate situation to be able to take advantage of a historical perspective on the oil and gas industry that I'd been afforded through my past career to capitalize on something in the industry, and that's what made me leave.
Today, I'm in Calgary speaking with Adam Waterous, CEO and founder of the Waterous Energy Fund, a highly successful oil and gas investment firm based in Calgary, Alberta. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. We're in Calgary, the oil patch, and you've been involved for decades in the oil and gas industry. What's the state of the industry today?
It may be helpful to just have a quick historic perspective, because in any industry, you can end up chasing headlines like, you know, hey, what was the price of oil this week versus 2 months ago? Mm-hmm. Which is sometimes not that instructive. You know, I'm mentioning a little earlier that I left because I saw what I thought was an investing opportunity I'd not seen in my career. And but to be brief about it is, what happened in 2014, 2015, is there was a large pullback in oil prices. Prices had been about $100 a barrel, and they fell in a short period of time to about $50 a barrel. And the oil and gas industry is a very volatile industry, and this happens from time to time. And it's known as a cyclical industry, and most folks thought that this was just part of the cycle. And historically, it's been advantageous to take advantage of market dips. And so if you look back in, say, 2008 during the financial crisis, oil prices fell. If you look back at the Asian financial crisis, 1998, oil prices fell. Go back to 86, oil prices fell. And this was seen by the industry as being part of the natural cycle. And generally speaking, it's been a good idea to buy in the dip because it was seen as a part of a cyclical change. I had a very different view. I thought it was a structural change. And that was being driven not by what typically has driven past dips, but was much more fundamental. And I quickly would say a lot of very experienced people in the industry, you know, 30-year veterans, you know, lots of CEO types said, hey, prices have come down, it's 2015, I've seen this before, and I'm gonna buy. Most of those people got vaporized. It was very tough. A lot of great careers got ruined thinking that it was a cyclical change.
Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Adam Waterous, CEO of Waterous Energy Fund in Calgary. I'm Coral Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. Up next, we'll talk about the future of the oil patch and oil.
Top-notch insight from proven leaders. This is the CEO Series with Coral Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again, I'm Coral Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. Today I'm in Calgary sitting down with Adam Waterous, CEO of Waterous Energy Fund. How did you see that it was not a cyclical change? Like, what was the couple of key insights that allowed you to see it better?
So I had, fortunately, an information advantage, and that is what we had done, how we grew our business over time is we really pioneered the auction market for selling oil and gas businesses and assets. And we started here in Canada, then we globalized it. Anyway, we ran effectively, to give you just a quick sense, over the previous couple of decades, something like 250 auctions. And these were big dollar auctions. You know, our average transaction size was $800 million. And what we saw is, and it was a great, very robust auction market in that for a very long period of time, it was a seller's market. And that is, typically when we were selling things, Carl, we typically get 10 bids on average. Sometimes the asset wouldn't be that great. We might get five or six. Sometimes it would be a really high quality asset. We get 15 or 20 bids. Tough to really get a bargain in these times. Anyway, and this has gone on for several decades. Anyway, what we started noticing in about 2013, is that the number of bids we were getting was starting to fall. And instead of getting 10 bids, we started getting five or six, and then it started going to two or three bids. And buyer demand was collapsing. And went into the 2014-2015 time frame, and the conventional wisdom was that prices have fallen, and that when prices fall, there's less capital available for acquisitions, and therefore the converse became, when prices improve, buyer demand will return. And I said I had an information advantage, and that is I ran these auctions in 2008 and 1998. And actually, historically, what's happened when prices fall, the number of bids you get goes up. And the reason being is people want to buy in the dip. It's actually a bit of a self-correcting dynamic in the industry. Now, the ultimate price you actually pay is lower because you use a lower price deck, but the actual number of bids you get goes up. Didn't happen this time. And what we did is I just asked the historic buyers, hey, you know, historically you were buying stuff, now you're not. What happened? And make a long story short, there was a technological disruption in that a new drilling technique, horizontal multi-stage fracs, had come along. And what that had done is in a very short period of time, transformed an industry which had historically been drilling location poor to drilling location rich. The amount of drilling locations a typical company would have had moved from, say, 2 or 3 years to often 10 to 15 years worth of existing drilling locations. What that led to is a preference to, while continuing to grow through the drill bit as opposed to buy it, but make acquisitions. And I realized that was a fundamental structural change that was going to cause, frankly, a lot of carnage in the industry. I thought, you know, that's going to present quite an opportunity to actually create a business that takes advantage of that new dynamic.
Today, I'm in Calgary speaking with Adam Waterous, CEO and founder of the Waterous Energy Fund, a highly successful oil and gas investment firm based in Calgary, Alberta. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CO Series. I mean, it's a fascinating insight. You had data, still a bit of a risk. So how do you take advantage as an energy company in Calgary? How did you take advantage of that? What did you do?
Well, we so what we did is, historically, the oil and gas private equity industry had a universal investing strategy, and it was a the industry was a early stage line of equity business designed to back strong technical teams to de-risk tier two, tier three assets, to build 5, 10, 20,000 barrel a day companies and sell them. And there were many firms, probably a couple of dozen significant firms across North America whose mandate was that. Those firms, to give you just a quick sense, backed with financial backers for roughly about 500 oil and gas companies in North America. That was the business model. And essentially why they picked tier two, tier three assets was they thought they could buy them cheap, but they'd have a really strong technical team, you know, strong geologists, strong engineers, and they'd have some form of technical hypothesis, could be bypass pay, could be a completion technique. And if they were able to solve that, they all got rich. And essentially it was a venture capital model. And the investment managers, the private equity funds, realized that. And when I say they realized that, it was actually quite risky. How they dealt with it is through portfolio diversification. And they said, well, we're going to raise a $1 billion fund. We're going to back 10 different management teams. We're going to give them each $100 million. And what the private equity funds would know up front is, you know, they're going to lose a lot of money on four of them. They're going to kind of break even on four. And a couple of five baggers is what they're counting on to make all the math work.
Yeah.
Venture capital model.
Yeah.
Again, it went on for a long period of time. And it was universal. And what we realized is that that model was broken because nobody wanted to buy 5, 10, or 20,000 barrel a day companies anymore. In fact, those 500 oil and gas companies that they had backed, we think probably 400 of them were illiquid. There was no bid. It could not be sold. So we didn't want to do that. And in fact, we instead developed a completely different strategy, and that is we were buying later stage assets, established proven assets that were on stream, generating cash flow. And generally our strategy was to acquire those businesses that were very high quality tier one assets and build a single operating business rather than a portfolio. And that's exactly what we did. So what we've made a series of acquisitions. They've all ended up being in Canada, I quickly would say, even though half our team's in the United States. And we've built that into a single scaled business called Strathcona Resources. So it's an operating business rather than a portfolio business.
Today, I'm in Calgary speaking with Adam Waterous, CEO and founder of the Waterous Energy Fund, a highly successful oil and gas investment firm based in Calgary, Alberta. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. So you would be actually involved, your team, in helping run those companies and giving them advice on what to do.
Yeah, so I'm the chairman of Strathcona Resources. You know, our team, our investing team is active in helping to manage that, having weekly meetings with the management team to try and help advance it. But this is now, to give you a sense, some of your listeners might be in, give you a sense on scale of the business. In 2022, we'll be producing somewhere around 120,000, 120,000 barrels a day. We'll have close to $2 billion barrels of proven and probable reserves, which makes us by far the largest private oil company in North America. And to give you a sense on that, and our revenue will be far in excess of $2 billion a year, which will make us the fastest growing company started in the last 5 years in Canada in all sectors.
That's amazing. So it's something where you saw a disruptive innovation or disruption in the industry. Long experience said this is true, lots of data, but took the risk of saying this is the way the industry is going to go in spite of most everyone disagreeing with you.
We were definitely in a club of one in terms of who were pursuing this as a strategy, and we remain in a club of one. You know, we are the only investment firm pursuing a scaled, what I describe, value investing strategy in the oil and gas business in North America.
Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Adam Waterous, CEO of Waterous Energy Fund. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. Next up, we'll talk about how the oil and gas industry is doing and where it's going and the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. So lots of things to talk about with Adam.
Exclusive access to some of the most successful leaders out there. This is the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again, I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. Today I'm in Calgary sitting down with Adam Waterous, CEO of Waterous Energy Fund. Adam, we're here in Alberta. So a couple of questions. One is about climate change, the role of Ottawa, where's all it going to go? Big questions that you're very well positioned. You've been here for a long time. What's the role of the oil industry with climate change? What should the world do, in your view?
Carl, how we think about it is we think the role of the Canadian oil and gas industry is to fulfill two primary mandates, two primary initiatives of the United Nations. We call them actually, internally we call it LEAP, and that is to LEEP, which is lower emissions and energy poverty. And I'll start maybe with energy poverty, which is obviously addressing as one of the United Nations principal goals. And again, but maybe for some of your listeners, to give you just some perspective, the United Nations defines energy poverty for those living on $5.50 a day or less, which is something around $3.4 billion. Approximately 1 billion people in the world today have no access to electricity, and another 1 billion have access to intermittent electricity, less than 4 hours a day. Today there are, according to the United Nations, somewhere over 4 million people die a year by inhaling indoor pollutants caused by burning wood, cow dung, to heat their homes. Addressing that energy poverty is an important role for Canada to play. And we think it's an increasingly important role for Canada to play. And to give you just a sense on that, Canada is going to represent by the end of the decade, by 2030, about a quarter of the free world oil, free world oil being investor-controlled oil. So Canada plays has a very major role in helping meet the United Nations goal of addressing energy poverty by providing dependable, reliable, and affordable energy, and oil, Canadian oil and gas is an important part of that. So that's sort of the first role for Canadian energy to play. The second, also United Nations priority, is to lower emissions. And the Canadian oil and gas industry, Carl's, some of your listeners may know, have been world leaders in reducing the carbon intensity of oil and gas. And to give, but some people follow it closer than others, but to give it some sense, since 1995, since Kyoto, the Canadian oil and gas industry has lowered its carbon intensity per barrel by 44%, with projects that have been contemplated, or are contemplated right now, between now and 2030, the industry is estimating that that carbon intensity will fall another 31%. So essentially over a 25-year period, the carbon intensity of the Canadian oil and gas industry on a per barrel basis is going to drop about something like 61%+. And now that's a track record unmatched by any other major producing oil province in the world. And now I quickly would say that is a never-ending journey, reducing the carbon intensity of Canadian barrels, you know, will essentially go on for, you know, for many, many decades. And Canada will continue to lead that.
Today, I'm in Calgary speaking with Adam Waterous, CEO and founder of the Waterous Energy Fund, a highly successful oil and gas investment firm based in Calgary, Alberta. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CO Series. Well, clearly, like, we have hydro in Ontario, BC, and Quebec. When I'm in Iceland, they have geothermal. So there's some great ways of getting energy, which is cleaner. But you would see that oil and gas, there's a role for them because of the energy poverty and just because of reality. Is that a fair way of putting it?
Well, yeah, no. So, you know, we're big fans of the entire energy spectrum, you know, whether it's hydro, renewables, or oil and gas. And, you know, for Canada's role, you know, what we, how we think about it is, well, we obviously need to have an obligation, a moral obligation, as Canadians to help address energy poverty. Meaning, put another way is, if we didn't produce oil and gas, we said, hey, we're going to leave it to OPEC to provide affordable, dependable, low-carbon oil to the developing world. That's a bad idea. So don't want to do that. That's why more low carbon Canadian oil and gas is obviously, you know, good for addressing energy poverty in the world. But at the same time, you know, Canadians, in addition to the reducing carbon intensity on a per barrel basis of the Canadian oil and gas industry, you know, Canada has the opportunity to also lead the world in reducing consumption, because as you probably know, Carl, with oil and gas, approximately 15% of the emissions are emitted during the production, 85% is consumption. So what we really have to work on, what the big opportunity in Canada is to work on the consumption. I mean, put another way is, I think if we're going to try and meet both those United Nations goals of reducing energy poverty and emissions, then obviously the oil and gas industry plays as an important role to play in fighting energy poverty. Even if we were to not have any oil and gas production, what our obligation as Canadians, and being the second one, would be to reduce our consumption. So that's where we see the big opportunity here in Canada.
Today I'm in Calgary. Having lived in Saskatchewan for a couple of years, it was a delight to be back in Western Canada. I'm sitting down with an old friend, Adam Waterous, CEO and founder of the Waterous Energy Fund, a highly successful oil and gas investment firm based in Calgary, Alberta. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CO Series. Next up, we'll talk about Adam's perspective on changes to the energy landscape in our country and indeed around the world.
They made it, and they're telling you how. You're listening to the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again, I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. Today I'm in Calgary sitting down with Adam Waterous, CEO of Waterous Energy Fund. Do you think work from home will fundamentally reduce the amount of, you know, of people going to work on mass transit or in their own vehicles, or is that just kind of a momentary thing, or, you know, for a year or two, and then we'll go back to growth in consumption?
I think that helps a bit. And, you know, if you look at some of the traffic data that has gone on, you know, as we emerge from COVID, a lot of these traffic levels are coming back quite close to what the historic norms are. Why we tend to focus on mass transit is ultimately that's going to be in the West one of the key ways to be able to reduce carbon emissions, because what's happening right now is primary solution is seen as the electrification of the transportation fleet. And challenge with that is I'm quite a bull on electric vehicles. I think number one, they're safer, you know, they're harder to roll over. Number two, they have lower maintenance than an internal combustion engine with fewer moving parts. But a third dynamic, which is very challenging, is that currently, every time an electric vehicle is being manufactured, oil demand goes up. And the reason being is electric vehicle, as you probably know, is up to 50% heavier than the equivalent internal combustion engine, and so has typical terminology is that it's embedded carbon. Batteries are much heavier. The steel that's required, you need more steel to obviously hold the batteries, make the car heavier, which is consuming a lot more energy. So weight's a very good proxy for energy required to actually manufacture the electric vehicle. So when you drive an electric vehicle off the lot, you start with a carbon deficit, meaning you've consumed more energy, more oil and gas, because oil and gas is about 81% of the energy system in the world. than an internal combustion engine. Now, how fast you get out of that deficit is a function of how clean your electricity supply is. So in a place like in Quebec, which obviously has some of the cleanest electricity in the world, you can go into a positive, let's say, net carbon basis pretty quickly. In the United States, on average, it takes about 200,000 kilometers before an electric vehicle breaks even on its carbon emissions. And of course, that's approximately 120,000 miles, which is generally speaking seen as the life of the batteries in the car. So these electric vehicles, well, I say I'm boasting them on the its user friendliness. That's not going to be a solution in terms of the West reducing its carbon footprint. It's going to have to be mass transit. We have to get people out of personal vehicles and into mass transit.
Today, I'm in Calgary speaking with Adam Waterous, CEO and founder of the Waterous Energy Fund, a highly successful oil and gas investment firm based in Calgary, Alberta. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CO Series. How's Ottawa? How are they doing relative to this industry? Up or down? Things you might suggest they can think about?
First of all, this is a very complicated issue. So I'm not unsympathetic to any level of government in terms of having to having to manage it. I do think that there is. I think one of the big positives that the federal government has done is by acquiring and building the Trans Mountain Pipeline. They, in part, have recognized Canada's role in fighting energy poverty, and I think that that's to be full marks for that. I think that governments around the world, it's not just this government, and specifically Western governments. Need to be able to try and spend as much of their energy as possible in trying to reduce fossil fuel consumption. And I quickly would say a carbon tax is a method of being able to reduce consumption. I would just offer that there's also some consumption protocols, which beyond just a carbon tax, if we're looking for meaningful change in consumer behavior. And by the way, one of the reasons why I call out electric vehicles is for many in the West, there's a notion, well, I'll just, instead of buying an internal combustion engine, I'll buy an electric vehicle, and then I'll be doing my share. Actually, that's actually not going to solve the problem if we really want to get to net zero. And so that's why I'm very focused, just as a quick digression. But one of the things that my wife and I are very involved in, we've lived in Banff for 24 years, and we helped start an initiative called Banff National Park Net Zero 2035. And essentially what that is, it is a initiative to make Banff North America's first net zero emissions community and do it by 2035. And a big part of that, and give you a sense on, we're working on building a train from the Calgary Airport to Banff so you don't have to take your personal vehicle into the park anymore, working on intercept parking. They make it more like a European mountain town, like a Zermatt. And one of the reasons why we're doing this is we hope it serves as a green transit laboratory for the rest of Canada, because, as it's been put quite a few times, is If Banff National Park can't become net zero by 2035, then Toronto doesn't stand a chance by 2050. We have to start looking at systems levels changes on a community basis, rather than just saying, well, a carbon tax is going to work. And I would quickly say, I'm not anti-carbon tax, but I would describe that as sort of necessary but not sufficient. We have to really look at how people are at consuming energy here, meaning going back to my point is, you know, we really do speak from a position currently in the West of energy privilege, and we have to think more carefully about how we can change how we function in everyday life in a much lower carbon way.
How many of the family work here? Is your brother still in it?
No. He retired a number of years ago. I actually have, so I've got three boys, my wife and I, and our oldest two sons are now working with us, which is super fun. I'm very, very fortunate, and I get to learn from them every day.
You're reverse mentored by them.
Absolutely. So, no, they came in with a lot of experience that I'm just trying to catch up and learn from.
This is the CEO Series. Adam, thank you for joining us today. We also like to thank our technical producer, Marco Campagna, and our show producer, Youssef Sahoni. Thank you for tuning into the CEO Series. À la prochaine.